Monday Mile podcast, the podcast all about inspiring you to plug your headphones in and join us on a little walk whilst we walk and talk. Today we are in Chelsea, in fact on one of my favourite roads in southwest London, Pavilion Road. Today's guest is no stranger to the area, having starred in E4's reality series Made in Chelsea for 12 years. He's been a bit of a pioneer in fronting the movement in equality, actually coming out as gay on the show. It's the pioneer himself, the gentleman about town. It is Mr. Ollie Locke.
Hello.
Ollie, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks so much. Thanks for having me.
12 years on Made in Chelsea.
I know, sad, isn't it? I think some people are like, you're going to get a real job soon. I was like, maybe, who knows?
Maybe, but just, why would I?
there is that point as well where we spend half the year away in fabulous locations and having a wonderful time. So it does make sense sometimes just to continue what we're doing.
And let's be honest, it is work. Having the majority of your life profiled and put out to the rest of Britain on one of the biggest reality shows in the country. That's no easy feat.
Weirdly, I'm used to it. And it's not weirdly, because it has been 12 years, but I signed my contract in October 2010, so it just shows how long ago that was, and I remember doing it so clearly, and it's just gone so quickly. In those years past that, we did something like, in the first 3 years, we did 400 club appearances. Thinking about that, 1,000 people each,
kind of, would be like 400 club appearances.
Yeah, as in club appearances to earn money, because you got paid so little money then. Yeah. I think when I signed my contract, it was about $5,000 for 6 months, which I thought was an awful lot of money. It is a lot of money, but for 6 months' work, it's not great.
Yeah, and especially living in Chelsea, southwest London, I don't think many people could live on $5,000.
So. Yes, it was a lot.
Exploit the club appearances, why not?
Quite right, but it was an awful. But we were working it out. We were like, that's 400,000 photos would have taken, probably.
That's actual madness. People. And back then you had the long, luscious locks.
That was it. Yeah, that was a difficult one, actually. I grew that when I was at drama school. And then when the show started, it became quite an iconic hairpiece. Because men didn't have long hair back then. It wasn't in the time where guys did. It wasn't cool then to have long hair.
Whereas now, it's a thing.
As soon as I cut it off, it became cool.
Are we going to see the locks reborn?
I tried to do it and it just doesn't work.
Oh, really?
I tried to grow it back.
What is that, old age or?
It is. Well, I can't, I don't know. I said it on Celeb Juice a while ago and he was like, why have you cut it off? And I was like, I don't want to be this 40-something-year-old man with long hair. And he was like, Keith Lemon was like, well, hello, that's me. I was like, oh, yeah, fine.
Sorry, not offending anyone at all. So take us back to the start. How does one go about entering a reality show? Because you started off in acting.
Yeah, started off as an actor and realised very quickly that I was a very poor actor. Actually, just didn't have any money. Didn't have any money, and I was a failed actor in London, and there wasn't anything to do, so I worked in nightclubs. And again, it's a bit like theatre. It's kind of a new audience every night. And I'd work in kind of 80s bars and stuff, so at least you have kind of ridiculous outfits, and it's like it's theatrical.
Did you enjoy that element of dressing up?
I loved it. It was great fun. Yeah. It was just silly and didn't take ourselves too seriously, and we get to drink doing it, so it was wonderful. And then, yeah, there was this rumour going around that this show called Made in Chelsea was being... Actually, it was called Chelsea Girls back then.
No way.
Yeah, I signed my contract. It was Chelsea Girls. Worrying, because they could have changed it. The production company were actually in... They had done Sun Sea and Suspicious Parents or Young, Dumb and Living Off Mum and all those kind of shows. And I was terrified. They could name it Rich Brats of Chelsea. Like, they could have, and we'd already signed our contract. So we put real trust in them to make sure that it wasn't. But luckily, it ended up as Made in Chelsea.
And here we are, 12 years later.
12 years later.
Your life has been thrusted into the limelight. So as someone who formerly spent time acting, to then go into a reality show, how much of that is real? And how much of it is and was a front?
Made in Chelsea is incredibly real, but you do walk onto a set, so because they have to make it look beautiful. It can't be like just a handheld stuff, because then you've got a reality show that's like a documentary. It's not like that. It has to make Chelsea look fabulous. It's got to live up to that kind of luscious, wonderful southwest London vibe. But everything you do and say is real on the show. And if anyone tries to be naughty and tries to do it, you're in real trouble. You're kicked off the show if there's anything that's not real.
So the people that we see on the programme and the people that become intertwined within the show, they're actually real life stories that are being inserted into a real life drama.
Absolutely right. And that is why people always say to me, like, why does Made in Chelsea work? Why has it gone on for such a long time? Like, how? It's because we're all bloody nosy. I think that's the issue. It's like, all of us love escape it. Life is very difficult sometimes. And so on a Monday night, when you can escape into someone else's world and you don't have to think about yours for an hour, I think that's why it's done well, with this fabulousness of kind of this extravagance of a different world, which is of kind of all these rich kids running around and
living
shagging each
lives.
Other. Yeah, just having a wonderful time and drinking too much, I think, is and people love it. And our followers have never been bigger, as in our viewers and all that kind of stuff. It's wild.
How do you differentiate between your life and life on set in the show? Is there a divide?
No, not really.
That's scary, no?
Again, I'm only used to that, so I don't know. But so going through fertility journeys and getting married on camera and that kind of stuff, it's just that seems like that's my job, which is weird. It's my job being myself.
It's weird, but also it's pretty incredible. Would you say it's changed you as a person?
It's difficult because growing up, when I was 23 and I'm nearly 36 now, so I think you're meant to change an awful lot during that time anyway, but
yeah.
Yes, it probably has. It's made me harder. I was always a bit of a soft wimp.
Yeah.
And now when you have to confront things so much, so if I have an argument with a friend, you don't go round the next day and bump into them in a nightclub and have to talk it out. You ignore them or text them and apologise. And so, yeah, I've had to grow and grow some balls and have conversations that sometimes I really don't want to have.
So in terms of, like, conversation and emotional intelligence,
yeah,
it's required you to drive that element of your life forward.
I think so, yeah. I think
that's a good quality.
It's not a bad one, because you do have to be quite firm every now and then in life.
But would you say it's put you in situations where things maybe that wouldn't have been a fight, they would have just got brushed under the table, have become bigger because it's being filmed?
I don't know, really. It's quite difficult. Recently, in the last series, there was a situation where I tried to make things better and I made it a lot worse. And that's just because, yeah, well, I suppose we were filming and we were chatting about it. Where I probably wouldn't have spoken to that person or just text them, but you do it on camera instead.
That's mad.
It's been an incredible situation.
Yeah.
And what a weird phenomenon that has been Chelsea. It's now played in something like 36 like different territories. It's now in America. It's mad. Australia, it's massive.
You know what's nice is to hear someone speak so positively about reality TV, because I think it's something that often people disregard it.
Absolutely.
Or maybe push it to the side or say they've had a bad experience. But to me, it sounds like you have a very, very positive relationship with the lifestyle it's given you.
I mean, yes. The fact is, when people go, oh, you're a reality star, like you've been on Love Island for 6 weeks or whatever like that, that is just a 6 week period. Remember, I've done this every Monday on TV for 12 years. So it's like, this has been I've grown up on camera. I became the first person to come out on national television in Britain. That was so long ago. And
you've made some history.
Well, I hope I've made some sort of progress towards helping people in whatever manner they can, if they do want to come out and stuff. Hopefully I've done something. I was in Los Angeles a couple of years ago with our exec producer, and I was outside having a glass of wine, and this American lady came up to me and says she teaches LGBT to their kids' school through my scenes on Chelsea.
No.
Yeah. And I was like, that is the best time ever to have said that, because I was with my exec producer and I was like, this is amazing.
This is why we do it.
Yeah, casual Rolls Royce just going past. We are in Chelsea.
love that.
Good, isn't it?
Two, in fact.
Of course.
As we walk past one.
Yeah, casual. £500,000 worth of car just driving past.
Next to £5.5 million worth
Easy.
Of house.
Easy, yeah.
I wouldn't mind living on this road.
I would very much love to.
One day.
Yeah,
we could be neighbours.
Yeah, we could have like cake sales and stuff like that.
Yeah.
Sell lemonade.
For £8 a glass,
yeah? Quite right, yeah. Extra for
because
the ice.
That's what you're going to get at the local sweet shop.
100%.
You're on a fertility journey.
Yeah.
With your husband, Gareth. That's incredible. I think a lot of people can seek inspiration from the process you're currently undergoing. Tell us how that works in Britain.
Britain is incredibly difficult, completely backward. They haven't changed the laws on IVF for 34 years, and they don't plan on doing so for another 3 years. The reason people go abroad to do it is because if you want an egg donor, you can't see their face, which is completely ridiculous.
That is crazy.
And so you have to choose from someone by just what you feel they might look like. Or they've got, you've got green eyes, you've got, you weigh this much, you're this tall, but you can't see their face. Which seems absolutely mad to me, but in America, you can actually meet them, you can discuss it, and then they basically, it's a contract where you go, yes, thank you very much, there's your eggs, it's a transaction.
Yeah.
And then there'll be no more rights whatsoever. So they don't have any rights to the children or anything like that. But in England, it's somewhat more difficult. If, theoretically, our surrogate, who's not biologically related to the baby in the end, she can fight to keep it because she gave birth to it.
No.
Mm-hmm.
That's scary.
Yeah, big time.
Because it's something that you've invested your emotional energy to.
Absolutely.
And then
right.
To have that taken away from you at the last moment.
Absolutely right. And I've spoken to loads of people about it. And everyone, one of the biggest things people say is, why didn't you adopt? There's so many children that need adopting.
Yeah.
And absolutely right. And if the government made it slightly easier to do that, that would be great. Gay friends of mine did it in Spain. This is heartbreaking. Did it in Spain. And the kid is now 7.
Yeah.
And little girl 7. And the mother's got in contact and they've had to give the little girl back.
So that's absurd.
I know. So this person has absolutely no idea who this woman is, apart from the fact that she gave birth to it. These lovely guys have adopted her. They've had to give it back.
So what's the process you and Gareth have gone through?
So we've just miscarried our third IVF.
I'm so sorry to hear.
But that's one of the things, and it's like we will go again, and it's just one of those things, but it's just heartbreaking. We started off going to Mexico, and we were in Mexico because we couldn't get into America because of lockdown. And so we had a Brazilian egg donor, she came up, and then we sorted all out in Cancun, that was fabulous. And then we ended up not working that time, so we had to fly the embryos from Mexico to Cyprus, because they wouldn't allow us back into the UK to do it.
No.
Because we had seen the face of the donor. And then went to Cyprus, we did get pregnant, and sadly miscarried 6 weeks later. And then we're now doing it in the UK, and I had to bite the bullet and say, well, it's just so expensive doing it abroad. And it's very expensive doing it here, but wildly expensive abroad.
Okay.
And so we're talking £100,000 kind of job, like, we're seriously expensive.
That's insane. I think a lot of people aren't aware of the process.
Even in London, it's probably 50.
No way.
Yeah. And that's before the baby's born.
Yeah.
So yeah, it didn't work there, so we did it on Harley Street, and then sadly we miscarried very early on. But so we'll go again at some point, we're just trying to work out what the next plan is.
Emotionally, that's got to be extremely taxing on you both.
Yeah. But again, this is something that I'm so pleased about when it comes to Made in Chelsea, because it's made me really strong. And this is a life thing, and where you could bury your head in the sand, I like talking about it. I like showing people that this isn't the end of the road. When it comes to IVF, there's a community online where I've met so many people that I'm now friends with, and it's nothing to do with Chelsea, nothing to do with fame, nothing to do with anything. The only thing we care about each other is that we all have a baby in the end. And so you've got this wild sense of community that's just it's just a lovely place to feel that you've got friends around you going through the same thing, even if you've never met them.
Do you believe you're destined to be fathers?
Yes. I genuinely, I have to be. There's nothing in my mind says that I'm not going to be a father.
And emotionally, obviously, that's massively taxing. How much time in between going again do you need?
Theoretically, one can go again, but we're just going to wait till next year and see what happens, really. Again, you've got to remember that the surrogate has gone through that physically herself, so we need to make sure that she's happy
okay.
to go again and all that kind of stuff. So,
Ollie, it's a lot.
It is a lot.
A lot, and I think something that's very hard to relate to as a female myself. I can't imagine being in that situation and wanting something so badly, but it's not just you two as a pairing, as a couple. uniting, there's an extra person in the mix.
Absolutely, of course.
Are you close with the surrogate?
Incredibly.
And you will go again with her?
Yeah, if she's happy to.
That's again, special.
It's just really special. It's also, there's new evidence, interestingly, that has proven that a little bit of DNA from her gets put into the baby.
Nice.
And I love the idea that there's a little bit of her always with us.
That's cool.
I really like the idea, and it's just, and she's a phenomenal woman, so.
Go on.
I like the idea of that.
I'm rooting for you.
Yeah, thanks.
I can be a little cheerleader.
Yeah, good. I think this, you know what, we've been so open on Chelsea about this, I feel that we've got a whole army of people wishing us well and wanting us to be fathers. And so it does feel wonderful that an awful lot of people in Britain are rooting for us, so it's lovely to have that sense of
Well, we help. Shall stay tuned and keep our eyes all across the journey, because,
thank you.
As you say, if it's meant to be, it will be.
And it is
he
definitely
or she.
Meant to be.
It is.
Maybe twins, who knows?
Twins would be the dream, right?
Can you imagine?
Knock
get
it out.
Over with.
Job done. Brother and sister, two girls, two boys. Anything as long as they're healthy. Too right. Talk to me about your husband, Gareth.
Yeah.
Got married on the show.
Yeah.
That's kind of surreal, having not only your relationship in the public eye, but actually the marriage on television.
Quite funny story.
Free wedding though?
Well, quite right. No, it wasn't.
No?
I paid for the wedding.
Oh, man.
So, yeah, I did pay for the wedding. And we had to. It wasn't Chelsea doing that.
You think it would be like a free wedding if you were given the all-access pass?
Well, you would think that. But actually, what was interesting is we get paid daily on the show. So that's when you film, you get paid instead of like a salary. And we actually gave our money back that we got paid for that day, because I never wanted someone to say, oh, you got paid to get married. And I was like, it just didn't sit well with me. So we put it back into the production costs to make it the most beautiful wedding we can. And I don't think it was cheap for the production to do it, because we had the Avengers Endgame lighting crew do it.
Wow.
Because you're lighting the Natural History Museum, which is where we got married, under the whale. And so try and light that. And there was only 13 people there. It was during lockdown, and we got married at 1:01 in the evening, because we could only start setting up at 6 o'clock, and it's a big place to set up.
That's late. So how did you spend the rest of the day? Were you nervous?
I was filming from quarter to 9 in the morning.
Okay, so positively distracted, would you say?
Well, no, it was exhausted. I didn't have time for hair and makeup. I didn't have time to do anything. I didn't have a glass of wine on my wedding day.
What?
I know, I wasn't allowed one.
Did you get to go and relive that day without the cameras?
No, we haven't yet.
That's got to happen, no?
We've got to have a party at some point, but it's just, we're trying to get the baby first. Let's get the baby.
Okay,
and then
baby.
And then we can have
then
a big old
celebration, the real celebration, right?
Then we would love to do a wedding again.
Nice.
Which would be amazing, because it's, although it was, but what was interesting is there wasn't a wedding that year, really. Kind of Princess Beatrice got married, Princess Eugenie got married, but it was kind of, there wasn't a big public wedding because there wasn't weddings around. You could have only 13 people.
So you guys stole the show.
Well, we
headlines and hello. Okay.
Well, we
Daily
did.
Mail.
We did actually. Hello was a coverlet, but we had the highest watched wedding worldwide of 2020. 3.5 million people watched the wedding.
What?
We actually beat Strictly that night.
That's a serious claim to fame if I've ever heard
one. Cool, isn't it?
That is quite cool, to be honest.
And also, it's the highest watched episode by over double of Chelsea's ever got.
No way! Yeah. I'm going to have to go back and watch that on YouTube.
It's so beautiful. It really is just the most sensational, and the music was wonderful. And it was a lovely day, but because everyone was trying to get out of London, because it was the night before second lockdown, the traffic was so bad that my dad actually missed the wedding.
No!
Because he was stuck in traffic, which kind of breaks my heart in every way.
Yeah, that's really sad.
I know, and Gareth was in a care home, so she couldn't be there. So it was all a bit of an emotional day, really.
How did you two meet?
We met, oh God, so many years ago, in China White's, the nightclub.
Oh yeah, that's a throwback, isn't it?
That is a real throwback. And we met there, and we were both involved in a fashion show, and we were both walking in a fashion show. And we were friends for 10 years and didn't do anything. And it was actually Jade Holland Cooper, who I went to university with. I ended up working for her as her first ever employee in the company Holland Cooper. And Gareth became
her. They're those really nice jackets, aren't they?
Really lovely, yeah.
Yeah. Is this a Holland Cooper?
This isn't actually, no, but I was her first ever employee, and we went around country stands and sold skirts and stuff, which has now become this enormous brand. Gareth was her managing director of the company. And every year, she's married to Julian Dunkerton, who owns Superdry. And so every year we always go to Cheltenham with them, and it's our very special, whatever, and we were all having a lovely time. And they say, guys, you've got to get together. And we were like, oh, don't be ridiculous, we've known each other for so long. And we kissed that night, and it was the last person I ever kissed. And we got engaged 7 months later.
That's incredible.
It was, I didn't think it was going to work, and it did.
Why did you think that?
I didn't fancy him at all.
He's and a good looking man.
He is, but he just wasn't. Also, we share a surname.
Yeah. We both had the name Rock, isn't it?
It was just a bit weird. But I never saw him like, I thought it was terribly dull. And then I remember sitting there being like, I remember sitting by the fire and it was snowing outside in their fabulous house in the Cotswolds. And I went, there's a dog that had terrible diarrhea. And Gareth was sorting it out and picking it up and doing everything. It was terribly funny. And I remember, as soon as that happened, I remember going, oh, that's it. I'm going to marry him. I know I am. It wasn't an excitement. It was like, oh, there it is. I knew it immediately. It was very strange.
Have you ever felt anything like that before?
Never, in a million years.
And
I was a real goer back in the day. I'd been around.
I've been a man about town.
I was. I had long hair, I was skinny. And a certain amount of fame, which I think drew people to me for the wrong reasons, but it was fun.
Did you ever find, in that situation, were you ever concerned that people liked you for who they saw on the television screen?
Yeah.
So I think that can be quite a worry for anyone in the public eye.
But if they were really fit, I didn't really mind.
Because I was a man about town.
No, but that's what I genuinely felt. I was like, I don't really mind that, as long as they don't cheat on me and
they look pretty.
Fit, sorted.
And at this point in your life, you like females as well?
Very much so, yeah.
At what point did that change?
I don't think it ever did, if I'm honest.
Really?
I think what happened is I was sort of, I felt like, whilst being on camera, I felt like I wasn't pushed into it at all, in no way.
Yeah.
I felt it was, by being bisexual, I think no one understood it back then. And so...
When was this?
I came out in March 2011. But I don't think it was talked about. It really wasn't.
No, there was only
Duncan James from Blue that was openly bisexual, maybe Alan Cumming, but no one talked about it. And so when I came out, I didn't get much work. I didn't get anything. There was nothing there, and it was all a bit weird. And as soon as I came out as gay, there was a lot more work.
Really?
As in, people started booking me for stuff, which they never did before. I think it's because people didn't know, that people saw it as unsafe, I felt. It wasn't a thing that people liked. They were like, oh, we like men and women. That's very strange.
Would you say it has changed?
An awful lot. Look, the conversation is amazing.
It's celebrated.
Yeah, absolutely right. So I would never... I read an article that really related to me the other day, which was from one of the guys in Queer Eye, Anthony. And he said he would never say that he was gay. He would always say he's bisexual or don't say anything, because he's had so many wonderful girlfriends in the past, he'd never want to upset them. And it's absolutely, aww. I completely understand that. I've had wonderful relationships with women and could still be, theoretically.
So would you say you've fallen in love with the person?
Absolutely right, and I did. When I got with Gareth, that was it. I wasn't immediately gay. I was immediately in love and knew that I wanted that as my story.
That's so magic on me.
So, yeah, no, I know. I've never really talked about that.
I love that. I absolutely love that. It is incredible to see the narrative change around equality. And I think by no means are we 100% there, but I think even in the last 3 years, there has been a significant change. Do you believe coming out on television, being in the public eye, representing everything you stand for, has made a bit of a difference?
I would hope so, but it's certainly not the reason why I did it. I just decided to go with a platform that I could talk about it, and that was really special. Not many people get the opportunity to share their life, their experience, their coming out stories with a country.
Yeah.
And also people were like, oh yeah, we knew you were gay all along and stuff like that. Well, I've had to say I was gay at one point, but now I'm openly talking about the fact that I'm definitely more bisexual than gay.
That's so interesting, considering you are married to a man.
Absolutely right.
But it's the power of love, I think, is the word here. And it's the connection of love which has narrated your path.
Absolutely right. And I've been incredibly lucky to be able to do that. But yeah, everyone was like, yeah, everyone used to say, oh, I knew he was gay the whole time. And you're like, how did Gabriella not see my first girlfriend on Chelsea?
Yeah, but also, how can you say that about someone that you don't know?
But also,
if you didn't even know.
Well, quite right. I was putting my life on camera at that point, what I felt, and that was the fact that I knew I liked men as well. And I was in a relationship that I wanted to get out of because I wanted to explore who I was. It just so happened that I explored it on national television.
Wildness.
Yeah, it was
crazy
a lot.
Crazy life you live.
I remember snogging a guy at an OK party of one of the editor's birthdays. I was absolutely arsehole. And someone came up to me and said, you know, you just snogged that bloke. Because I was going out with Gabriella on the show. Well, I was going out with Gabriella, but on the show.
No.
We were broken up, but it hadn't come out that we were broken
no.
up. And so I did a deal with the Daily Star that they get an exclusive if they don't write about it until it comes out on television. So very early on, I learned how to negotiate with the press about giving exclusives and stuff.
Always good to have that in the back pocket, the ability to negotiate.
Yeah, bollocksed in a nightclub. After snogging a man. Yeah, great.
For anyone that maybe is listening to this podcast who is maybe looking for their way out, it's still something that I think a lot of people going through the process of understanding themselves struggle with coming out. Is there any advice you have for youngsters who aren't sure?
I think for starters, take it very much at your own pace and speak to others that you may feel that are going through that. I always think that's what godparents are for. Because it's not your parents. I would always make sure there was a naughty godparent that you know you can go to when mum's being an arsehole. And you're like, mum or dad are being an arsehole. You'd be like, oh, what's going on? Go to the godparent. Like, they'll sort it out. You can go and vent to them.
Unattached soundboard of advice.
Absolutely right. Who cares for you and is there to look after you as well? And I think godparents are always a really good thing for that. There are so many resources you can now speak to and as I do with IVF, I make sure that there's a community, and there is a community out there for anyone going through coming out and all that kind of stuff, and LGBT. There's always a community and a group there of someone to talk to, and I think talking is the most important thing.
Too right, in every element of life.
Do you never find it when you feel a bit rubbish about something and you talk to your mate about it and you go, oh my God, I feel like I'm letting it out, and you do.
Yeah,
that's why Americans do therapy so well, because they talk, they just open.
Yeah. No, 100%, I love a chat.
So do I, which is why we're doing right now.
It is. This is why we're mining. What's your routine like, day to day? Do you have a normal week, Monday to Friday, or is it quite sporadic?
I absolutely have no normal day, normal week, normal month.
How do you manage that? Because that in itself can be quite tricky to find a balance.
Again, I don't know anything else. I've never had a proper job. I worked in nightclubs. You haven't either. Have you not?
No.
No.
I started snowboarding when I was 16.
Yeah.
I don't think that's a normal job, do you?
No, I did work experience once in a estate agent. I fell asleep. And then I worked very briefly for a work experience in the Marks and Spencer's magazine. And then I went to nightclubs, and I've never worked in an office.
Do you think you would gain anything from having more of a routine? Or does the sporadicness of life keep you on your toes enough?
I would hate a routine. It's not what I want. I go to bed late. I wake up quite late, if I can.
I love it.
And I sit there and I have a glass of wine and I thoroughly enjoy myself. And as long as I'm on good form and I do my work where I can, then that's what I do, really.
That's all that counts.
Yeah, isn't it exciting that you don't know what you're doing the next day sometimes?
It is, isn't it?
Yeah, I love it. I wait for my agent to call me and say, oh, you've got something for me. Wonderful, I love it. Thank you very much.
Wonderful, where are we going today?
So that, yeah, and it's... Yeah, and it's always fabulous things of meeting lovely people, and I love meeting people, so that's really important.
Yeah, me too. I love it. What's your relationship like with Monday, the start of the week?
My relationship with Monday is weird because Sunday is my favourite day of the week.
Why is that?
Well, that's my boozy day.
Really?
Yeah, always.
Ship Sundays?
That is very much so. Not the ship anymore because it's all full of we and the loos. It's all kind of drunk
perfect.
Australians.
Yeah, we don't do that.
But Sunday's my favourite day and it's always my boozy day. Richard Arnold and I were talking about this the other day. It's always his boozy day as well. But he's always on Monday morning or Good Morning Britain, he's always hungover because he's had a boozy lunch the day before.
Brilliant. I'm going to look out for that on Monday.
Quite right. But yeah, that's always quite fun. But yeah, Monday's not my favourite day because it also means that Monday night, you can't really do an awful lot. You can, but no one wants to go out on a Monday night. And
they don't, do they?
And I live for the evenings. As soon as the sun goes down, it's my time.
Not the biggest fan of a Monday, then?
Not a wild fan of a Monday at all, but...
But it's all good. We've got the Sunday vibes going. Low-key, roast dinner, few bevvies.
An awful lot of red wine, yep.
I love it. You're also not just a reality star, so to speak. You are in the process of... writing a book.
I have. I've had three books out. Well, no, this is my third coming out in April. But this one's really special. And it's a series of books called The Faraway Adventures of Henry Boggett. And it's about a little boy who finds magic in London by going through the blue plaques and the walls of whatever world that person lived in. So the first one's Herb Merville, who wrote Moby Dick. And so he goes back into 1851 Nantucket and into an adventure with the whale, with Moby Dick. And so... yeah, he goes through a portal and back into their world.
Wowza.
It's a series, two a year for the foreseeable future.
Wow. Yeah. Congratulations.
Thanks.
That is huge. And where and when can we get our hands on a copy?
That's out on April 25th.
Awesome. That is coming around soon.
Isn't it?
Are you done? Done and dusted with the first one?
Oh, it's all done. It's all, it's all
very printed
organized.
And sorted.
The second one's being written at the moment.
Brilliant.
And that's out in October. And that'll be April, October every year.
Nice. We'll keep an eye out for that.
Thanks.
And lastly, Ollie, do you have any life mottos or quotes that you live by that you can share with our Monday Mile listeners?
I always think it's a friend of mine, Daniel Lismore, once said, "Be yourself because everyone else is already taken." And I thought that was quite sweet.
Wow.
I thought it was quite cool.
That is cool.
And if I was to get a tattoo, it would say, "Sail away with me." And I don't know why. I like the idea of going to the horizon.
Where are you going into the horizon?
To the other side. And that's another thing. It's not the other side of death. I'm not dying.
I was going to say, did you see the horror in my
so
face?
So dark.
I was like, wow.
He's weird. No, I wrote a book years ago about a little girl that sailed past the horizon and into a different world called the Islands of Fandai.
That sounds rather nice.
And it was really sweet and I loved it.
Tropical.
Very tropical.
Tropical on this very frosty morning.
Quite right.
Ollie Locke, thank you so much for joining us here on the Monday Mile Walk and Talk podcast. It has been an absolute pleasure digging into the depths of your journey because you're certainly on a rather fast ride.
It's a bumpy one.
It's bumpy.
But I wouldn't change it for the world. If they can give me a baby, that's the only next thing I want. And that's it. Thanks.
Well, here's hoping, wishing you and Gareth all the very best of luck with this IVF journey. And here's hoping that the next news you receive is positive news. To all of you out there listening, I want to say a massive thank you for joining us. I hope you enjoy the stroll. And we will see you next week. Monday Mile, it's a wrap.